Welcome. We're in the Committee for Government Accountability, General Government and Accountability. And I'm going to open that meeting now. We have an informational meeting. We have three concepts, and we're going to start out with the broadband legislative concepts. So do you have anything before I call them up? So Representative Marsh and Mr. Wolf.
We'll just plunge right in.
Yeah.
Senator Riley, members of the committee, thank you so much for having us. I'm Pam Marsh. I'm the state representative from House District 5, which is Southern Jackson County on the other side of the state. We are here to talk to you today about two broadband proposals that we're working on for 2019. And the backstory, briefly, is this. Oregon has been involved for many years in broadband, but on an opportunistic and occasional basis. When we've had money from the federal government, we've handed it out, and I think, well, we have some good systems to show from that for that. But we don't have any ongoing capacity to really plan strategically for getting broadband out across our state. As a result, we still have a minimum of 400,000 Oregonians and 50 schools without any access to broadband at a time when we understand that this technology is key to economic development. It's the way we communicate. It's the way we entertain ourselves. It's pretty much key to everything that we do in the outside world. So we are bringing today two proposals to you that we think will actually jumpstart Oregon, that will give us the capacity to make sure that in the next few years, every Oregonian will have access to the technology that runs their businesses, propels their schools, and is a mainstay in their personal lives. So we're going to kick it off. Brant's going to present the first proposal, and then we'll share the second.
Thank you. My name is Brant Wolf, representing the Oregon Telecommunications Association. The OTA represents traditional landline-based telecommunications providers. We don't represent the wireless industry or the cable industry. They have their own separate groups that represent them. As Representative Marsh indicated, our concept, which we will, I detailed in my testimony just a bit, but basically relates to the Oregon Universal Service Fund. Most people don't know what the fund is, how long it's been around, what it's supposed to do, et cetera, et cetera. So I'll provide some background on that and then move into the concept, if you don't mind. The fund was created in 1999 by the legislature. It was based on a voice-based system. In other words, the fund was used to support, was meant to support the telecommunications network in rural Oregon for voice purposes only, making calls to and from one another. For that reason, well, maybe not for that reason, but anyway, the fund was created for that purpose. When that legislation was passed in 1999, the wireless industry was considered, rightfully so, to be kind of a nascent new technology. For that reason, they were granted an exemption in the enabling legislation. So from 1999 until today, the wireless industry has not contributed any revenue whatsoever to the Oregon Universal Service Fund. We have, our members have objected to that all the way along the line for the following reasons. A wireless phone call, data, text, whatever it is, whenever that call is made to and from rural Oregon or any other place for that matter, it uses the landline-based telecommunications system that's there. It's present all the time, always operating. Their business depends on that network, and they pay nothing to help support that network. They don't charge. Our members can't charge for those calls, and we don't charge for those calls. And the industry doesn't pay into the fund to support the network that they use. That's a fundamental flaw in that program, and it has been since its entire existence, in our opinion. The legislative concept that we will have introduced and hope to pass will rectify that situation. It will just eliminate that exemption and have them begin to pay into the fund. The second part of our proposal would create a broadband grant program, grant or loan. Those details need to be worked out still. And we support that notion for the following reasons. The legislature in 2015 and 2017 basically have done this already. In both of those sessions, towards the end of the session, Requests were made, and funds were appropriated for broadband programs, different projects around the state, with very little oversight, at least as far as we know anyway. And we think a professionalized, properly funded, properly vetted broadband grant program is the right way to go. If anybody has talked to me over the years, you know, we historically have taken kind of a dim view of these kinds of projects, but they happen. We know there's a need. We don't really object to them all that much as long as they're appropriately used and in place. And so for that reason, we support the development and funding of a broadband grant program. You can see in my testimony, I made some, there's some bullet points there. I'm hoping you guys have some questions or comments for me, but the current surcharge is 8.5% on the voice only section of a landline telecommunications bill. It's not applied to the internet piece of your bill. It's not applied to interstate traffic, only intrastate. So it's all within the state of Oregon. And the when the wireless folks can start to contribute, it'll be the exact same way. The Federal Communications Commission has developed what's called a safe harbor provision on any kind of a wireless bill, and it just kind of separates out the total bill to that amount that they think can be assessed as surcharge. And that's in the law. The cap is in the law. The fact that there's a cap on the surcharge, which we support, that was in our – let me back up a little bit. So the fund, as I mentioned, it only supports voice systems. Last year, in 2017, the OTA introduced, and it was passed and signed into law, a bill that gave the Public Utility Commission the authority to use this fund to support broadband as well as voice, which was a necessary first step in this entire process. This bill, this concept, is just a second step to that, to fully fund and make sure the fund is healthy and viable into the future, and that it supports broadband, which is what people want and need for education, for economic development, healthcare, all the things that we know are important to Oregonians in rural and urban areas. As I mentioned, the wireless providers use the landline network to complete their calls and transmit data. We think they ought to step up and help fund the support mechanism for this in rural parts of the state. The fund balance itself has gone down as landlines have been dropped. I think we all know. Well, if you don't, the landline drop has been steep and dramatic over the last 20 years, to the point where we used to have, it was a monopoly, it really was. There was about 2 million landlines in the state, and that's down to about 400,000 now. So the fund balance has shrunk dramatically. The reason there is a fund, or the main point of the fund, is that our members are regulated utilities and they have what's called a carrier of last resort obligation. That's found in the statute in 759.506. And it mandates that our members provide service to everybody within the areas that they serve. Everybody. That's why we have this fund. That's why we have the support, because of that obligation. The question arose this morning in a presentation similar to this in a different committee. The question came up about why. Why don't these carriers, why don't the wireless guys pay you? Why don't you charge them? The answer to that is pretty simple. When this fund was created in 1999, there were charges called access charges that carriers assessed against one another to access those areas where we served. The wireless guys paid us, we paid them. That's how we compensated one another. That was called an implied subsidy. You paid that as a consumer, you just didn't know you were paying it. So policymakers at the federal level and the state followed suit to eliminate those access charges and replace it with this. That's why that happened. That's why we are here today, to ask you to have the wireless guy, or consider having the wireless guys pay into the fund as well next session. There's probably other things to say about this that I'm not forgetting or I'm not remembering. If you have any questions, please just ask them. I'm sure I can provide an answer or get back to you if I don't have an answer. And I think I covered all the bases. Did I miss anything? Did
sure.
I have anything else?
May I add a couple comments? Thank you, Chair Riley. Just a couple of things. One is to look at some real numbers, because I think all this makes a little bit more sense if we actually provide some numbers to you. And these are numbers that are based on PUC projections, so we have a good source, although, you know, honestly, we won't exactly know some of the details of this until we start to put it on the ground. But what we know is that there are about 3.7 million handsets of one kind or another across the state. If we take a conservative estimate of the piece of that bill on which we can place a surcharge, and we estimate that surcharge at 6%, which is less than the 8.5% currently paid by landlines, we can generate around $39 million. The current fund is generating $28 million, so we would be able to stabilize that fund, and as landlines decline, we wouldn't see a decline in those revenues. And we would generate out of that an additional $10 million to be put into a broadband fund to be managed by Business Oregon, with the intention of really supporting our rural communities as they build out their broadband systems. So the average cell phone user, what would that mean? It's probably about $10 to $12 a year. Those who have landlines would actually see a decline in the surcharge that they are paying at this time. So it's an evening it out. When Brant and I do this presentation, he always hits the fairness question because he's representing the telecoms who are charged with maintaining all of this infrastructure that the cell phone providers are using, and for which the cell phone providers are doing nothing to support. My part of the presentation is really the social contract. You know, 20 years ago when we Oregonians passed the Universal Service Fund, we did so with the understanding that we are all better served if all Oregonians have access to a landline, was part of what we agreed among ourselves. Today, the social contract is really about broadband. If you don't have broadband in your community, it's a generational issue. It's the way we do business. It's the ability to function like your peers can who are in urban cores. So I think this is really a fundamental social contract issue. The last thing I would add to what Brant noted is the kind of obligation that we're asking of our cell phone companies. And in your committee materials, you'll see a document from that was generated by the Tax Foundation, conservative organization. And in that, we see 50 states plus two territories ranked in terms of the obligation placed on cell phone providers. You will find Oregon there as number 52. It's easy to find because it's at the bottom of the list. We don't have sales taxes, obviously, and we don't have wireless taxes. All we do have is a 1.98% obligation that goes to fund the 911 system and some supports for residential telephone service. So there's a lot of opportunity and a lot of precedent for us in the way that other states, the other 51 states and territories, have gone to cell phone companies and asked for partnerships to support these kinds of programs. So we think it's fair that our cell phone providers do the same thing at this point. And I think that's it, unless you have questions on that piece. We have a second piece to talk about, too.
Yeah, so I actually have one other thing, Mr. Chair, if you don't mind. I have a PowerPoint that I did for this, and it didn't work this morning, and it didn't work here either, but it was stunning, let me tell you. It's amazing. It's a thing of beauty.
I saw it. It was stunning.
Yeah. So so I'm looking at that as Representative Marsh was speaking, and there's a couple things that I neglected that I think we need to or at least mention, and that is 5G. We all hear about 5G and the rollout of 5G and how important that is to our economy. And those, however that happens, in whatever communities that happens, it points out that it needs to be stressed that 5G service will still rely on the landline-based telecommunications system. I think that needs to be said for the record. And then also, I have some examples if you'd like. If you want me to, there's at least one really great example of a small business that thrives with this, if you'd like to hear it. And if not, then we can
move on. Yeah, but before that, Senator Linthicum, you had a question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize for showing up late. This is just too tight for me. Good grief. I got one thing and another thing, and here I am. On the back side, you both spoke about some numbers, 2 million landlines down to 400,000, and you referred to 3.7 million handsets. I'm assuming those are cell phones. The numbers don't make sense in my mind. I'm assuming, one, that the old $30, $25 landline monthly charge at, you know, the 8.5% of that for 2 million people is entirely different than the $120 charge for a cell phone today at the 6.5%. So run through those numbers. How does that really cash out, in, or do I have my equation set up wrong? Or both, right?
Senator Riley, Senator Lithicum. I think we can answer that in part for sure, and we can share with you the PUC analysis after the fact. I didn't put it in the packet because it's a lot of numbers, but I'm happy to share it with you. So in terms of your whole cell phone bill, that surcharge is not going to apply to most of that bill because it's not going to apply to your internet, and it's not going to apply to your out-of-state calls. So when you parse that down, you get to a fairly small number on which it will apply. The PUC has estimated it between, I think, $10 and $20 on as the base for which the surcharge would apply.
Okay.
So it's a whole different kind of bill.
Excuse me, follow up.
Go ahead.
So basically that whittles down to just within the state numbers or phone calls or whatever that percentage, if all of my conversations take place across the Washington border, then my percentage would be very small because I'm not talking to people within, you know, the state of Oregon. Is it based on historical data? This month I'm calling everybody in my local county and I'm not talking to anybody in Idaho. Therefore, this month it's a larger percentage. Is it whittle out like that?
You know, there are some calculations that put it down to a standard number, but as Brent noted, there's a safe harbor provision by the feds that say that you can use this safe harbor calculation and assume that that's a pretty close estimation of what that part of the bill is that should be subject to the surcharge.
And if I may follow one last time, define how the safe harbor gets calculated. What does that look like? Brent can do it too.
Yeah, I don't know if I.
Sure.
It's a calculation made by the FCC.
Right. Senator Riley, Senator Lithicum, yeah, Representative Marsh is absolutely correct. The safe harbor is a formula developed by the Federal Communications Commission that attempted to get the very thing you're asking about. You can't assess the surcharge on the entire $120 or $200, whatever is the bill. You have to whittle that down somehow to make it reasonable. And the PUC hasn't yet determined what that amount is, but it's going to be in the $10 to $20 range. That's commensurate with the $35 local bill of part of my bill that I pay my landline telephone bill on. It's meant to sync that up somehow, and I could not tell you how they developed that. I just couldn't tell you that, but the figure arrived at is $10, $15, $20, something like that,
as the base.
Okay,
right.
Well, good, thank you.
And that's long-standing practice. And the other thing to point out is that Oregon, there are other states that have done this. I had a slide developed that pointed this out. But Oregon, we won't be the first state to do this. In fact, Nebraska and Utah developed similar programs just in the recent year and a half, 2 year period of time. And there are other states beyond that. And we're actually fortunate in Oregon to have a fund to be able to even think about this with. There are many states that don't have this kind of a thing. And I think that they suffer because of it. So we're fortunate we can even have this conversation here.
Any other questions?
A clarification, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, the presentation, the animations didn't work properly, but you can page through the slides that are available on our website. It's at least posted in that form.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. He wanted to give us an example, so I
just
wanted to give him that opportunity.
Yeah, sure. So
an example.
It's kind of a fun one. It's monitor cooperative telephone company. It's not that far away from here, and it makes two points. It's probably 20 miles, 25 miles as the crow flies, so it's not that far away. But in Monitor, in that exchange, it's kind of an isolated little exchange over around Mount Angel, but the Wooden Shoe Tulip Farm is in that exchange. And as you may be familiar with the Tulip Festival, it's grown from a small little festival to over 100,000 visitors every single year. It's a really thriving business. They do international business. And the general manager at the Wooden Shoe Tulip Farm has told me through my board chair that is, not my board chair, but a board member of mine that at the phone company there, that they have been able to grow their business and the festival over the years as Monitor Telephone has been able to give them bigger and better broadband. There's a direct correlation between those two things, and it's a very successful little business. That's the first piece. The second piece I like to point out, and I tell lots of people this, you don't have to be remote to be rural. You don't have to live in Jordan Valley to be rural. You can live in Monitor or Mount Angel or Sio or any other dozens and dozens of places, and it's a small rural farming community. And access to broadband is very important to them for their businesses and their education and healthcare and things of that nature. And that's what this fund supports and is meant to support and will continue to support, hopefully. That's my example.
Great. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Actually, you have another.
Right. A second proposal that we can talk about fairly briefly. Thank you. And first, just a little bit of background from me personally. While I live in Ashland, I have a business that's up in the woods at 4,000 feet. And by hook or by crook, we finally put together broadband for our community. It's a little wireless system. It's a co-op. But we have it. And not a day goes by when someone doesn't walk into my business and say, oh, you have broadband. I could live in this community. That's why I'm so passionate about this, because I think every community across the state of Oregon, and especially in our little outback areas, needs to have that same daily experience of knowing that they have the tools that they need to live and to expect that their children might return at some point. So with that background, when I got up to Salem and got appointed to the Oregon Broadband Advisory Council, I was astonished to look around and see how little capacity we have to work on broadband within this state. And so the second proposal, along with the stream of funding, is to develop a broadband office that would live in Business Oregon. The intention of the office would be to put somebody in charge of supporting our local communities, providing technical assistance, helping them do planning projects, and ensuring that we grab every single federal or other kind of dollar that comes by that can be invested in our local communities. Interestingly, John Huffman, and I think he would not mind me noting this, our former colleague who's now with USDA Rural Development, has become one of the biggest cheerleaders for this. And I think the reason is because he sees that there are opportunities for us to get some kinds of outside funding. But until we put an office on the ground and someone in charge of making sure that we understand the technology, the needs of our local communities, and that we can match up money that comes along with those communities, too much is going to go right by us, and that will be a story of missed opportunities. So we want a broadband office with three or four people. They will be in charge of developing a strategic plan for ensuring that all communities across the state get broadband. They'll be the cheerleaders and the supporters of our local communities with the intent of rolling out broadband that is technology neutral and provider neutral. We're not going to make those judgments, but what we are going to do is really give a hand to every single community across the state to make sure that all individuals get online. So that's the second part of this, is we need a stream of funding, and we also need an office that can make sure it gets to where it needs to go.
So could you tell me why you chose Business Oregon?
Sure. We had a work group that was representative of a number of departments. We had someone from the CIO's office. We had someone from the regional solutions team, from the legislative fiscal office. And we batted it around a lot. We looked at the PUC, because the PUC has a little bit of regulatory responsibility in this realm. We looked at the CIO, but the CIO really does internal work on this. And we finally decided, and I think unanimously, that Business Oregon was the right place for it to work, because number one, it's very clear this is an economic development tool. That's okay. What Business Oregon deals in, and that's the fundamental reason that we need broadband in our communities. Business Oregon has relationships with entities and with local communities, so they are in a position to immediately reach out and establish relationships across the state. And Business Oregon knows how to deal with infrastructure, and this is, if anything, an infrastructure investment across the state. So it just seemed like that was the right home for it.
Okay, yeah.
And they said as long as we gave them money, they were eager to have it, because I think I think they understand, as we all do, that this is central, and there's so much happening in the technology field that if we just don't put somebody in charge of it that we're going to miss.
Yes, I think we have missed a few times already, so I agree. Any other questions? Yes, Senator Lefkoe.
Out of curiosity, are these two ideas, the funding and the Business Oregon, in the same LC, or are they separate?
We're running them in separate LCs. We think they're both really essential, and both would be an improvement independently. Right. So we wanted to keep the conversation separate, but we're a 1-2 punch here.
Right.
You have anything else for us?
I think that's it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Riley. And just note, we did put some supporting documents in your committee materials.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So next we're going to have an update on the reverse auction pilot that we put together in 2018 with Senate Bill 1565.
Hello.
Oh, you don't look like Brian DeForest.
I'm not Brian DeForest. My apologies. Folks from DAS were called away on an emergency, okay. So I volunteered to be the person to provide the update today.
Great.
Delighted to be here. Chair Riley and Vice Chair Thatcher, my name is Barry Leslie, and I'm the Deputy Chief of Staff for Governor Kate Brown's office. And I am delighted to be here today to provide you with an update to one aspect of Senate Bill 1665. Which passed during the 2008 short session. Given that state government spends about $8 billion per biennium on buying stuff, modernizing the state's procurement system has proven to be one of the best opportunities to change practices in order to save money. And one aspect of Senate Bill 1565, which does just that, is what we in the procurement world call the reverse auction methodology. You may remember that a reverse auction is a way to collect the pricing offers from pre-screened and qualified bidders. It occurs at a specific time and date, and it's online. And it's sort of like eBay, except for that the price gradually goes down instead of going up. Bidders can see how many firms they're competing against and then what the competing bids are, and they can continue to enter lower bids until the auction closes. And then at the end of the auction, the identity of the bidders is revealed. So the bill required DAS to pilot this method for up to 10 individual procurements in 2019, and those would be procurements that are valued at $150,000 or higher. So DAS formed a project team to work on implementing this pilot and has selected a vendor to actually work with them on selecting appropriate opportunities for the auction format and to run the auction on an online platform. They plan to begin using this methodology at the start of 2019, and they plan to, at the end of 2019, report back to the legislature and, of course, the governor's office on the savings that will have resulted from using this new tool. So that's the update in terms of the reverse auction methodology, and I'd be glad to answer any questions you have or bring answers back.
Yes,
I didn't really have a question, but it seems like this is way too easy for you just to walk away. So.
Chair Riley, Senator Lithicum, but you can totally let me if you'd like to.
What were the 10, you know, what's the nature of those? What do they look, what's their size and shape?
Chair Riley, Senator Lithicum, that's an excellent question. As I did mention, they will be those opportunities which are greater than $150,000. And during the review of this type of tool, what we noticed is that these were most effective when you're buying a large volume of a singular item. So fuel or 20 vehicles or 35 computers that are all going to be the same type, because that's the best way to really leverage the price down on that type of opportunity.
Okay.
So I have no questions, and apparently the rest of the committee doesn't.
Right.
So thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
So now we're going to move on to an update on the Oregon Transparency website. So Dave Schultz, I can't say that name, and Paul Newsom, I can say that name. Proceed whenever you're ready.
Good afternoon. Is the microphone?
Okay. Yes. It's
a little hard to tell. Good afternoon, Chair Riley and committee members. My name is Paula Newsom. I am in the Department of Administrative Services and work for the Chief Information Office, State CIO, and am currently the Oregon Transparency Program Manager.
Dave Shrike with the also with the Office of State CIO, the new Director for Shared Services, Enterprise Shared Services. I've been here for about 3 months, an Oregonian who was in Arizona for about 8 years and come back to the state of Oregon, and really glad to be here and working with a lot of great people doing a lot of good things. So it's nice to be here today. Thank you.
And you should have a PowerPoint presentation, and I'll make note that many of the items are hyperlinked. So for any of the concepts and details, many of those do show up in a bright orange color based on the template. Today we'll cover some background guiding principles, some information about subscribing to updates for the website, talk about our advising commission. We'll do some exploring, as you wish, to walk you through a bit of what is on the website. And finally, some highlights and summary information. So about us, how did all of this begin or start? It started with House Bill 2500 in 2009. And this is what actually launched the transparency website. This is a hyperlink in your information. And so at any time as you're going through this, you can actually pull up many of the resources that are being referred to here, such as House Bill 2500 from 2009. Subsequent bills have expanded the data and the informational reporting requirements since 2009. The About Us page on the website provides a listing of many of those new bills that have come about, either House bills or Senate bills, that have become part of the ORS for transparency. The ORS was updated last year in 2017, and this is the most recent listing for ease of use and your review and referral. The About Us page, and I'll refer to navigation and show you what I mean. On the website, and this is the About Us page of the website, there is a navigation tab. And when I refer to navigation, I mean the left gray sidebar. And under About Us, you can see that by year and the historical information that is mentioned, that many of the bills that have occurred over time are what adds to the content that we'll be looking at this afternoon as we go through and give you an overview of the site. And you can see that there has been much content over the years added to the site. And again, this is simply what the homepage of the site looks like. If you have not visited, this will provide you a hyperlink as well that will take you out to the site for additional review as you wish. This shows some of the navigational changes. The stars indicate specifically new categories or content that have been required or information that has been merged as we've gone forward over time. For example, we did in 2016 add the transparency update portion and have an ease of use way for people to subscribe. We'll be talking about that in a few moments as well. But that is what this is showing, is that it is not a static process, but has actually changed as we've gone forward in time and more legislation has been passed and changes have been made. Annually, throughout the year, there are an ever-growing amount of entities, agencies, data, and information that is required and for posting on the site. Some of these involve the agencies that you see listed, such as our executive branch agencies, Business Oregon that was mentioned in our prior presentation this afternoon, lottery, treasury. I'm involved with info and gathering info from 36 counties, 19 education service districts, also the Oregon universities, university programs, community colleges, and in 2017 as well, quasi-public entities, enterprise zones, as well as general expenditure, revenue, workforce, budget, and contract data. So it is an ever-growing range of information that we've been providing. Much of this data, larger data sets, and when I refer to a data set, what I mean would be as if you've worked with something similar to an Excel worksheet, where you actually have a content and some type of quantitative figure, whether it's dollars or quantity of something expressed. So for data sets, a majority of those for the program reside on what's referred to as our data.oregon.gov web portal, and much of it can be found through the data catalog, and this is where we place it for links and ease of use on the website itself. We are still, as a program, the largest individual data set owner in the state. The data sets, and that's in terms of what is actually present on data.oregon.gov. As of last week, there are many different types of data out there, but those that are specifically defined as data sets for the transparency program, gave you a few numbers here. We are at 39.4%. Through some consolidation efforts and cleanup work, and consolidation, when I say that, I mean putting data together that is similar from varied years so that the public and those that are looking at it can go to one data set instead of multiples for ease of use in their review. Also to mention for the program, we have had external benchmarks for our program through what's referred to as USPIRG, or Public Interest Research Group. This is just an overview to show you over the past 6 years, on average, our score has been 91% roughly. And that's over the course of the last 6 years. Our guiding principle, but yet our core constraint with transparency, and this can be reviewed as well in the statute, is that all of the data sets, the reports, information, and any resource links that we do provide are all to be managed and deployed at no additional cost, using existing data and resources that are available through the state agency, education service district, without any reallocation. So per the current statute, this is the guiding principle, but yet is also a constraint as we move forward. On the informational side, let us hear from you. We have various ways. You can email. You can fill out an online form. Much of this is available through the Contact Us page Also, the homepage of the website has our email address and links to the informational form available for you. The Contact Us page looks similar to what you're seeing on the screen and has similar information to what is on the cover page for the website. You do have some options in emailing. We have a distinct email address. You can also fill out the form. What this allows is that if citizens or others wish to fill out a form and drop us a comment, and we do get some of those, they're not required to put their name or email address. However, if they do not, I don't really have a way to respond, but at least can look and see what some of the comments are. So that does allow a wider range of comments and information to be provided. You can also subscribe to Oregon Transparency Update. There is a sheet that I had asked her to provide you with aside from what is in your packet. It looks like this. And you can go to the website if you're not already signed up. And there is an example in the handout of what the August update looked like. Part of the premise in the statute is also not only to provide information and place it on the website or work with the different groups. Part of it is also to educate, and that is also part of the statute. And so what the transparency update opportunity allows anyone, any citizen, anyone to subscribe is to be given on a monthly basis a little short comment about one area of content, because as you can see, there is quite a wide range of content that we provide through the website. Our Advisory Commission for Transparency is the Transparency Oregon Advisory Commission. They also have a page on our website in which you can visit and review our members, current staffing. You can look back at any past commission meetings and look at any of the agenda materials. We also have links to the Legislative Fiscal Office biannual legislative reports, and resources and historical information. This will take you back to some of the original agendas from 2009 if you wish to look back further at some of the history. Through the Commission in 2016 and 2017, worked to come up with some draft vision and goals for the transparency program going forward in the future. This is on the website. But for your ease of use and review, you can also take a look. There are a total of 8 goals, and this was vetted through the Transparency Commission's work group, and quite a bit of work to come up with the goals going forward for the future. For exploring the website, I pulled up just a few of the larger categories or topic areas. One in particular that there's quite a bit of interest in and for which we do receive quite a bit of visitors and or traffic to the site is that dealing with our state workforce. So on the website, when I refer to a data set, for example, this is a multi-year data set of salaries, you can visit the data set and actually search or sort the salaries from least to greatest. You can also search based on the agency or year. And if you have an interest, this particular data set includes data from 2015, 2016, 2017, and the most recent for 2018, as of fiscal year 2018. And so with this, you can also choose to export and actually download any of these files as open data, being able to download them onto your own laptop or desktop at home, or any citizen can do this, into most likely an Excel-based format for the purpose of sorting and reviewing and looking at any of that information that they would like to see. One that many, I believe, at the legislature may have an interest in is our performance measures. Working with the contacts in our legislative fiscal office over the past year, and there's links to their information on the site. This includes the annual performance measure documents that agencies are required to provide to the legislature. And this allows you to see, for example, I'll just look at the first, the State Board of Accountancy for both year 2017, 2016, the date they actually published it or put it forth, and then it is available in PDF for ease of use and review and download. And so as their documents come in this year and as updates are made, the next year's documentation would be added here as well. This is an actual data set as well that resides on the data.oregon.gov site. Depending on your interest, you can see that there's a wide range of other areas on the site, including those for economic development, quasi-public entities, higher education, and education service districts, as well as many others. Those were just a few of the items I thought that the committee today might have an interest in. Is there any in particular, aside from the few that we've looked at, that you see on either of these two pages that you would like me to open up? And
yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I well, first of all, I do appreciate this presentation. Very interesting, and especially when you're talking about the measurements that everyone has to present. Could you go back to that chart again, please? That or that slide, performance measures.
Performance, yes.
So I was wondering, so all of the individual departments forward that information to you, and you compile all that data and place it here, or how is this arranged? How are you collecting this data?
Thank you, Senator Manning. That used to be the case, yes. Only those that are required to report this information to the legislature, the data does actually or was actually sent. 3 or 4 years ago, that meant for each of these different types of PDFs, which were close to somewhere between, I'm going to go back and estimate and say 85 to 92, I would receive 85 to 92 separate PDFs from the Legislative Fiscal Office. They would send them to me. They were managed, they were uploaded, they were linked, and they were actually placed on a page within the website. That was the past process. With this process, and with working with Legislative Fiscal over the past year, decided to come up with a better way to do this, and so set up a data set on data.oregon.gov, set up a process for it, vetted it with LFO, and they agreed to work with me on this. And so as the data comes in now, instead of having three or four different management and check-in levels, if you will, when the data comes in, can be placed directly here for use. Does that answer your question?
Well, just follow up. You had mentioned that only required, and we're talking about transparency. So I would talk offline, because I would like to know, if we're talking about total transparency, who is required and who is not required, or who's not reporting, because if we're going to be talking transparency, that would mean to me that everybody is transparent, to include people that say that they're technically not required.
Senator Manning, for that, there's quite a bit of text on the site, and there's also a link here to the LFO page. The specific agencies and the guidelines for any exceptions to reporting, they would be the best contacts, and I can also follow up with them after this meeting in regard as well. But for any, there have been situations where one year, for example, an agency that reported actually got acquired or blended into another agency. So that group one year no longer existed the next. They became a subset of a different state agency. And so the requirements also change for a wide range of reasons.
Thank you.
Any additional pages or links that you would like to look at?
Well, I like the public meetings page, but it confuses me sometimes. On how to sort for a particular agency. Like if I want to look up, I don't know, a meeting happening with OHA and foster care or something. I'm not sure how to search for something like that.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Thatcher. I would ask there's two different ways to review the data. For example, under the monthly, this is set up to give you a calendar view. So the graphic and the presentation is such that it does look like a general calendar format. If you know how the organization is named, you could do some searching here. But a more ease of use way in which to sort, if you had a particular agency, depending on the time frame, is to look under the quarterly reviews, which are in more of a tabular format. And so if you knew the specific agency or group that you wanted to look for, you can also, as you see here, these are arranged generally by date. If you wanted to sort these ascending or descending, this will put all of the accountancy state board meetings for this quarter, float those to the top. And, you know, basically when you pull this up, it's in order numerically by date. If you wanted to see how many meetings has the Department of Agriculture planned for this quarter, based on this, using that naming convention, they have a total of 5. This commission has 2.
Annette, you brought up something, naming convention. Is that new? In other words, is the accountancy state board always referred to as the accountancy state board, or is it sometimes the state board of accountancy? You know what I'm saying?
Thank you, Senator Thatcher. Yes, in the public meeting manager, it is standardized.
Okay, good.
Anytime there is a new agency or some special commission, perhaps, from the governor's office. There is a master table or template either that I have access to that I can go in and add if there's a need to add. We try not to do that if a group is a subset of an agency for just those reasons. It's easier to find things at a higher level. But yes, within the public meeting manager, which is the application behind the scenes that allows for each agency, and there are many who actually enter these meetings on behalf of their agency.
Go ahead. So going back to my question on looking up something about foster care, and I'm not sure if it's under OHA or if it's under DHS or what. If I wanted to find something on foster care, can I do a search and it would come up with everything about foster care under public meetings, or is there that ability yet?
From what I'm looking at, and I simply opened the third quarter and just typed in foster care, there are two meetings, Child Foster Care Advisory Commission, out of the governor's office. That's where those actual terms show up, written in that particular format. The meeting title is something that the agencies or groups if I type in foster as well, that's the only place that that particular term is used. Mm-hmm. So I'm simply in the search window here where you see the little magnifying glass, just typing for something I'm interested in, and then just choosing to revert back. I'm not saving anything, I'm just changing it back. But this is out of the quarterly. You can also go and look at the full year. For this year, these are the quarterly meetings. You can also pull up and take a look at for the full year, and we also have a few links to some of the past years. So if you had an interest in wanting to go back and see what was covered, is there another keyword or topic that anyone
it
would like
goes
to
look at? Wow, as many as you want.
Well, because we were just talking about in the last meeting, so foster care kind of comes to mind. But you could pick anything. You could pick Transparency Commission if you want.
And this is for what we were just looking at was for the third quarter. This is actually looking at 2018, the full year, putting in foster care. And can see that wherever that term foster care is used in the meeting title, that has showed up.
And it's my understanding you can find minutes to these meetings where they were taken on the same site?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Let me... And Senator Thatcher, I'll say that with any of these meetings that we're looking at here, as we move the horizontal bar at the bottom of the screen, we can look over and see additional information. And if there has been an agenda, or they also will often have a web link if they don't have an agenda, they may actually have a link to web link to meeting minutes and summaries. This would be wherever they're choosing to place this information. And so from that meeting can look out and see for those particular days, there are the meeting minutes, or this is the page they plan to put the meeting minutes on, even if they're not yet published. Is that?
Yeah, no, that's extensive.
It is. So what kind of education, public education, is done about this website?
Senator Riley, in relation to, may I ask, in relation to what range and scope?
Range and scope. So a lot of times we put out some kind of information to the general public on Facebook or on just maybe a public announcement of some sort about things that are going on in the government, and this would be one that I would like to see more people know about. So that's kind of the question, is how do people get to know that this even exists and how to get to it?
Thank you, Senator Riley. Currently, one way that people become familiar with it, of course, is we do have information on the site. It is promoted nationally through our third-party assessment. On a more local level, if we take a look at the website for on data.oregon.gov, which there are links to this from the primary website, oregon.gov. You can get to the transparency website from oregon.gov. It is under the governmental listings tab, and also from data.oregon.gov. The transparency update that you have is open to anyone in the public, and have promoted that as time permits and in giving flyers such as this, and plan to do more of that. And I'm very open to doing that. It's a matter of time. More recently, I can say that our OSPRG committee member on the advisory commission back in the spring did do a radio presentation on Jefferson Radio. Would you like to speak to that? Little on that?
Well, I think what I listened to it and was rated, we were rated a B+, I think, on the, was it a B+, I think, or B-? It was a B, and we got a lot of good publicity from that type of thing, but we're not doing, that I'm aware of, any other real outreaches for that.
So I'm sure you agree with me on this. We've talked about this many times. I would like to see you do more of that. And I know it's time consuming and stuff. So, but I'm sure you could do interviews on OPB. I mean, there are a whole lot more people that listen to OPB than the Jefferson website. There are only us liberal folks who listen to Jefferson. But so, you know, I'd like to see it go in many more places. I'm sure you could get many radio stations of all stripes to do this sort of thing, and I'd love to see that.
And Senator Riley, one thing I had thought of as well was to, we have not moved in that direction, and a lot of it does deal with resources and time.
Of course.
But also perhaps work toward a module of some sort that on a very simple level could be used in the schools so that the school children could get familiar with what's out there, what the resources are, and start learning about, as they learn about personal finance, hopefully, state finance, because that would carry over. It would have multiple uses. But also to mention, we've provided greater and greater access and information. We cover a wide range of financial, workforce, business, legislative, and educational areas. And information in some cases is machine readable. We still have some challenges in that area. By machine readable, again, I mean something in more of an Excel style format that can be downloaded and used. But again, we still have our core constraint that we're doing all of this with just the existing resources. Mm-hmm. There isn't additional resources and so forth for any type of cost-related activity. And although we've achieved quite a bit and we've come a long way, we still have some constraints that remain. And in order to continue the current level that we're doing and continue to move forward, as you've seen, we've had additional statutes, additional legislation passed, but to continue to maintain and then move forward, additional support and resources going forward will be needed.
Okay. Thank you. Yes.
I get that. Yeah. But I also think that I think the legislators themselves need to be more informed about it to begin with, before we even talk about
good point.
Reaching, and then that could actually be a catalyst for
it. Could be. Good point.
Sending this information and education out to the community.
Yes, Senator Manning.
Mr. Chair, I was just looking. I was perusing the website and stuff, and I didn't notice that. I don't know if it's even relevant, it's the right place, but I didn't see anything that people will be able to click as they're browsing through this, a link to legislators. Or is it not for, I understand where we're going with this, but there is one that was showing the governor's bill signing and stuff, but if someone wanted to say, okay, well, I want to get some information on my state legislator, if there is a link or a page that will take them over to that area as well. I didn't see it, so just thought.
Yeah, a link to OLIS or something.
Senator Manning, I think the one of the closest things we, excuse me, I think the closest thing that we would have, I understand, I believe what you're saying, would be some of our links that would take us directly to parts of the website that are required. And again, this takes us over to the legislative site.
Okay.
However, what you're mainly seeing here with the time and the resources and even extra oomph is to, at a very bare-bone, basic level, meet the requirements and try to go a bit above them in terms of the resources that we have. So everything you see on the website is what is statutorily driven, and then anything else that, and you can see there's quite a wide range of information and contacts, but we can certainly entertain
what So what you just said is, if you want something, write a law.
Yeah. Give me more
with money in it.
Yeah, give me more money. Yeah.
With money in it.
Thank you.
Any further questions?
No, but I think you do human's work down there, and I don't think people appreciate all that you have done to it is a big dump load of information you get to try to organize and put out there so it's accessible for people.
Yeah, but I want to emphasize that Senator Thatcher has worked on this ever since she got here, right from the beginning in 2005. I know that's the case because I've been beside you many times when you were working on it. So, thank you very much.
And thank you, Senator Riley. If there is an interest in adding some component, a walkthrough of the website, a walkthrough of the resources, to any onboarding that new legislators go through. We would be more than happy to accommodate and to assist in some capacity. We just need some direction and feedback on how to best go about that and who the appropriate folks might be.
Maybe through the senators who are on your board.
And at any time, if you have questions or would like for any other additional meetings, a walkthrough. With that, if there are no other questions, I would also invite you to attend the Oregon Transparency Oregon Advisory Commission meeting. The next one will be held this Thursday, and it is here in room H174 at the State Capitol from 10 to 11:30, where we will be getting into more detail and content and than what we have done here with reporting back for information.
Unfortunately, I have another task force at that time, but thank you for the invitation. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank
Appreciate you.
You
being here.
Thank you.
So that wraps up our agenda. And anything else for the good of the order from members? So I'm going to adjourn. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.